This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll get an update on the travel scene at the San Luis Obispo Regional Airport.
Passenger confidence when it comes to getting in a metal tube and sitting very close to people you don't know for several hours, there's a lot of concern about that in any environment right now, let alone an airplane.
Also, we'll hear from Michelle Call of San Luis Obispo's Gay and Lesbian Alliance.
Just because we didn't have the awareness we have now doesn't mean that those protections shouldn't extend to people of all sexual orientations and gender identities.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, June 22nd, 2020. I'm Carol Tangeman. Conversations are taking place all over the country about the removal of Confederate statues and names, even in the military, where 10 Army bases are named after Confederate officers. San Luis Obispo author Nicholas Ballardis recently wrote about growing up in Bakersfield and going to a high school steeped in Confederate symbolism. Valley Public Radio's Alice Daniel spoke with him about his essay, which is published in the online magazine Boom California.
Nicholas Ballardis, welcome to Valley Edition. I'd like to start by asking you to read the section of your essay called A White Mythology.
Thank you for having me. I'm just going to jump right in. A White Mythology. Confederate and Civil War imagery surround me. It's 1982. I'm 14, a freshman at South High School, home of the Rebels, the Blue and Gray, the Merrimack Yearbook. Johnny and Jody yell leaders in military-style gray uniforms and Confederate hats. Our mascot is a cartoon Confederate soldier. I don't understand what I'm seeing. I don't understand racism, slavery, war, who fought what or when and for what cause. I'm so caught up in our school spirit, I pin a tiny Confederate flag to a Confederate soldier hat my Mexican-American dad brings home from a swap meet. He thinks it's cool. I think this is what high school is all about. Rebel soldiers, like Star Wars, like The Empire Strikes Back. I don't realize a cartoon mascot is a symbol for retaining an economic system that allows for the horrific right to own slaves. I somehow think I'm one of the good guys. Street names around South High are all Civil War inspired. Sumter, Merrimack, Monitor, Rebel, Raider, Evelyn. Evelyn might be Evelyn Magruder Desjarnet, a white 19th century writer. She taught slave kids on a Virginia plantation. She culturally appropriated them by writing stories in slave dialect. Her husband was a captain for the Confederate Army, a farmer who owned slaves. Take a turn down white supremacist lane onto Monitor Street and you'll reach Plantation Avenue. An elementary school by the same name still stands there. So do the street names.
And you added the word supremacist to the essay. It's just called White Lane, correct?
Correct. You know, when you look at a map of that area, you can see all those street names and it's really shocking. And you see White Lane. And White Lane, I don't necessarily think has anything to do with the Confederate names, but it's strange when you look at a map, it just jumps out at you.
And you end with the line that the school names and street names are still there. But what if anything has changed since then?
Well, really nothing's changed since then. You know, this area was born out of the 1950s in city planning, and it's very sympathetic to this notion of Southern pride and Confederate imagery, a Confederate white mythology built into the fabric of a community. And since then, the street names are all still there. Plantation Elementary is still there. South High is still there. But the only thing that's really changed that I've seen is not only was the Confederate flag banned from South High's campus in 1968, but the mascot itself, the only thing that I've found that's changed is now it wears a baseball cap, but the same artwork is still there.
Well, in another section, you write that Black and brown kids lose their self-identity in this imagery. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
You know, I think that when communities aren't allowed to be themselves, then I think when you have something like this, this white superiority complex, it so permeates the culture they live in, the community they live in, it completely indoctrinates so many students, and this is in the thousands of students, Black and Brown, who've gone to South High, who've gone to Plantation Elementary School. And so I feel like there's a part of people that gets taken away from them, from that experience.
And you write about that experience from a personal perspective too. You're 14, the mascot is a cartoon Confederate soldier. And meanwhile, your dad, who is Mexican American, is giving you a Confederate hat to wear. And we learn as we read in the rest of the essay, he's also kind of preaching whiteness, telling you you're white. Talk a little bit about him and how your relationship with him changed over the years.
Well, you know, my dad, you know, just like South High and Plantation and all those street names popping up in the 1950s, and my dad was a teenager in the 1950s in San Jose, California, and he lived at a time when this romanticization was happening in America of Southern pride, which also happened in California. It happened in places like San Jose, California, too, which we know nowadays, like Bakersfield, is a place that has a huge number of Latinos and Blacks. And so, but during that time in the 1950s, you know, my dad had odds stacked against him to assimilate, this idea of total and complete assimilation. So, you know, I think that my dad was kind of a victim of that, but I obviously don't like how that turned out with my dad, because I think once he joined the San Jose State Police Academy as one of the only Latinos there, I think that, well, let's look back to the 1960s now, early 60s, how can he not be indoctrinated into this sort of, you know, white mythology? How can he not be assimilated? Now, later on in life, you know, part of the good story about this is, you know, later on in life, my dad was, he didn't have those same racist views. I was really glad that he didn't. But once again, you know, these are all really complex issues. And I think we as people of the Central Valley have to admit to ourselves how really complex our families are. The issues of racism and race are in our own families. And so, you know, I think we have these long story arcs of our own, and they just get really complex.
Well, I was wondering how his proximity to whiteness and telling you you're white informed your relationship with African Americans as a kid.
You know, it's really sad in how it informed my relationship, because on one hand, I had my dad saying, you know, using racial epithets that, you know, weren't good to use, obviously, and saying things like, you need to be afraid of people of color. Now, come on. I mean, growing up in a home that's dual ethnic, my dad is a person of color with really, really dark brown skin, and he's telling me to be afraid of people of color. So that, you know, that informed me in a way that made me afraid. But at the same time, you know, you grow up, you learn things for your own. You learn that you can have Black and brown friends and not have to be afraid of people, that kids sometimes are smarter than the adults around them and can figure things out and say, yeah, you know, my dad's just kind of wrong about these things. And of course, you know, it also took me years to reeducate myself, because that wasn't going to come from the home. It was going to come from myself educating myself and going to college and becoming a history major like I did, and going to graduate school in history, and just learning on my own that I don't have to be what my father tried to make me to be.
And monuments are coming down all over the country. Names are being changed. Is this a conversation you're hoping to start in Bakersfield with this essay?
Well, it's time for change, don't you think? I mean, that's it's happening all over California, this discussion of monuments. And in Bakersfield, you know, there's a couple of plaques that are Confederate monuments. But what's staring people in the face in that community is what I bring up in the essay, is you have these schools that have these names like Plantation, that, and you have these Confederate streets named street signs. You know, those kinds of things need to be part of the conversation too. You know, why not name the school after a Black doctor or a Black teacher, a Latina labor leader? Build a necessary and new kind of community pride. And because, like I said earlier, literally thousands and thousands of kids are going to these schools, and they are just learning to accept sort of like this Gone with the Wind image of plantation. When we know, if we as Americans are looking at our history, that is a candy-coated image. The real image is that plantations built on a slave economy. And slaves were emancipated. And to have that imagery now, in 2020, it's just not acceptable. So, it's time for change.
Well, Nicholas Bilardis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Valley Public Radio's Alice Daniel speaking with Chicano author and San Luis Obispo resident Nicholas Bilardis. A new report from UC Merced shows undocumented workers have been hit the hardest when it comes to job loss during the pandemic. As Valley Public Radio's Mari Bolaños reports, this is especially true for women in non-essential jobs.
Before the pandemic hit, 59-year-old Maria had steady work cleaning houses in Merced and Winston. But COVID-19 changed everything. When the governor told everyone to shelter in place, the homeowners called me and told me not to go to their homes until this is all over. That meant a huge loss in income. Maria made pretty good money, about $1,000 a week, but she says her clients were all older people who feared contracting the virus.
So I stayed at home after that because I'm also older and have diabetes, so getting another job will put me at risk too.
She's lived without documentation in California for the last 30 years, and she's asked us to use her first name only. And because of her status, job opportunities are also limited, she says. Doing agricultural work is not really an option.
I used to work in the fields, but I fainted twice due to the heat. It's hard for me to be out in the sun for long periods of time now.
Right now, she's staying at home where she shares a two-bedroom apartment with one of her daughters and four grandchildren. Her daughter receives welfare that covers the rent, but Maria is still responsible for paying the utilities.
Not working has affected me a lot because I have no money and I don't receive any government aid.
She tried applying for the California COVID-19 Relief Fund for undocumented workers, but she says she was never able to speak to anyone.
I spent the entire month of May calling and never getting through to anyone, and I imagine it's the same experience for others that have tried to use it.
Maria's story is not unique, says Edward Flores, a professor at UC Merced, who is researching recent job losses in the state. He says undocumented workers are getting hit the hardest.
In California, one out of every four pandemic-related job losses was among non-citizens.
And he says it's even higher, about one in three for women who are undocumented and doing non-essential work, especially in the service industry.
The service sector has been really slammed by the pandemic, and this is where a lot of immigrants and women concentrate, and so that's why it's affecting these groups most acutely.
Flores's research is based on the U.S. Census Bureau's current population survey for February and April of 2020, which shows trends in job losses. And when the economy does start to improve, Flores says undocumented women will be the last to recover.
The research shows that people of color and that women, those persons who are most marginalized in the workforce, are the first ones to be fired during a crisis and are the last ones to be hired during an economic recovery.
Recently, Maria did find one cleaning job. Right now, she's ironing a stack of clothes. She says it makes her nervous to return to work, but she also needs to pay her utilities bill.
This woman owns a ranch. I clean her house three times a week, and we make sure to keep a distance. It's not ideal, but it's what I have to do to earn some money.
And she's staying productive in other ways. Maria volunteers with an organization where she helps package masks for people working in the fields. She knows she can't do field work herself, but she wants to make sure those who do stay protected. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Mari Bolaños.
the airline industry has seen unprecedented changes in the last few months. Correspondent Tom Wilmer reports from the San Luis Obispo County Regional Airport with another conversation with Airport Director Kevin Booman. They'll discuss the current protocol of transiting through the airport. They'll also focus on in-flight COVID-19 precautions and the state of the airline industry as people are beginning to think about traveling again.
With soap and water, we're using alcohol-based hand sanitizer. Thank you. Together, we can help to prevent the spread of illness.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from the San Luis Obispo County Airport in San Luis Obispo. We're here with Kevin Booman, who's the airport director. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Tom.
Strange days continue, COVID-19 world.
We are certainly in interesting times for the airport industry and the travel industry, but all industries. We have remained continuously operational during the event. You know, as a transportation infrastructure asset, you know, our obligation and our intent is to be available for the public to, you know, to travel both within the state of California and access interstate travel as well. So we certainly have been operating at a reduced schedule in terms of our flights per day. And of course, our passenger volumes are way, way down, but we have remained online.
Some regional airports have lost carriers, but you have American, United, and Alaska who have continued to stay
there. Yeah. We have sustained all of our carriers. We have had some routes suspended or frequencies reduced.
Give me an example.
Yeah. Well, Contour was the first carrier to reduce, and they suspended Las Vegas service. And then San Diego was suspended. The Portland launch has been deferred until this fall.
But you're still serving Seattle.
We are still serving Seattle, Denver, Dallas, Phoenix, mm-hmm. and San Francisco. Los Angeles was actually suspended as well. United has reduced operations.
So there is no direct flight from San Luis Obispo to Los Angeles?
Not at this time.
Wow.
We're expecting that back in July. It's tentatively scheduled to come back in July, but we have seen some markets suspended. We're optimistic and confident that those will return. But for the time being, given the low demand for travel, it's very difficult for an airplane to fly empty.
That's interesting because Los Angeles International World Airport, major hub, you know, I'm shocked that that was dropped.
You know, and that isn't just our market. Los Angeles has seen, you know, reductions on a scale of what we've seen here, but if you look at United specifically in Los Angeles, they've reduced their level of activity there dramatically.
Interesting. Well, I have a flight out of here Saturday, and I was a little shocked because they routed me through SFO.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, well, why didn't they take me to LA? So
right.
There you go.
Right.
Yeah.
We are anticipating additional frequencies coming back with our markets that we are sustaining. Hard to predict at the moment when those are, but we expect in July we should see some additional frequencies on most of our markets.
Yeah, and that's another dynamic of the strange days. It's an ever-moving target.
It is.
You know, what United is thinking about or plotting this week might change next Monday.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then you consider the global aspects of a pandemic as areas become hotspots for various reasons, not the, quote, second wave, but just hotspots per se, that certainly affects demand in unusual ways.
Mm-hmm.
And concerning to think about the impacts of a second wave, not just for our industry, but businesses of all sorts, that if there is a true second wave, I'm concerned for all of us.
Yeah, I mean, we're in the middle of the first wave, and it's scary.
Yeah.
You know, I'm flying into Texas, like I said, Saturday, and that's a hot spot in the country right now.
It is. Yeah. And, you know, when we look at, you know, the industry as it recovers, you know, this has been the largest financial disruption to aviation, really, in the history of commercial aviation. There's never been anything like this. And, you know, you look at any other global event. You know, you and I have in the past have talked about 9/11, or you pick any of the other pandemic-related events that have occurred globally. The aviation has never experienced this. So even the modeling for what do we expect next is really kind of working within a black box. We just don't know. And there's elements of consumer behavior and attitudes and shifts that may take on a permanent or a long duration level of change. You know, the reasons for travel, how people travel, why they travel, when they travel, you know, all of that, I would say, is very much to be determined because of this.
a concern that I've had for years has to do with sanitation of the aircraft, the tray tables, the seats and whatnot. So there are some infrastructure good things that are coming out of this even when we come out the other end.
I believe so. I think that air travel, much like many other forms of public or commercial transportation, have never had sanitation or hygiene standards of a caliber that I think what we're seeing today mm-hmm. is now an expectation. And clearly, you know, there's air filtration and other types of things that occur as part of the development certification of the aircraft.
Let's talk about filtration and air quality. We both know that airlines typically use an enhanced HEPA filter that's a hospital grade.
Sure.
And that's people just don't know, and
yeah.
they question that healthiness of the air in an aircraft because it is recirculated.
It is recirculated very frequently and filtered to a very high level. Granted, you've got a lot of density in the cabin on a full aircraft and a lot of potential sources of contaminants in there. And so it, you know, it needs that level of filtration. But I think what we're seeing now is a very intense focus on all the surface contact within the aircraft, and then of course the precautions that travelers need to take to occupy the aircraft. The reality though of commercial aviation being sustainable at a reduced passenger load, though, is unfortunately just not possible.
Yeah.
You know, you hear discussions about, you know, the future of the middle seat on the airplane.
Being reversed.
And yeah, either being reversed or eliminated or however, even just redesigning an aircraft interior. And of course, that's a long project for certification with a lot of investment, unknown impacts to customer response. And of course, the financial viability of just saying, well, we're always going to have a reasonable amount of spacing on the aircraft beyond what we have today. It would dramatically change the economics of air travel to where it would be unaffordable for most folks. We've kind of been through this golden age of aviation here in the last many years with affordability like there's never been.
You know, air travel
for the masses.
Way before you were born, when I was a kid, I flew to Honolulu from San Francisco on Pan American Airways. My flight was $350 round trip in the 1960s. And you take those $1960 and you translate them to today, that's equivalent of probably $1,500, $1,800 for that flight.
Mm-hmm.
So some people don't realize that the economy of scale of affordability of air travel is unbelievably cheap.
It has. It's really changed, and it's opened up the world to people that never potentially had access to air travel because of cost as mm-hmm. the primary barrier. Now, with that has come dramatically different business models with ultra low cost carrier, you know, kind of this race to the bottom in pricing and services, which serves a need and a demand. But at the same time, it's created some economics that are very challenging if you look at now, well, let's take a certain number of seats offline in the airplane. We'll see where that settles. I will be surprised if that's ever a permanent change that mm-hmm. the airlines make. But for the time being, everything's on the table
as
they look at what can we do to restore customer confidence in flying. I mean, that's the real core of the issue is passenger confidence when it comes to getting in a metal tube and sitting very close mm-hmm. to people you don't know for several hours. There's a lot of concern about that in any environment right now, let alone an airplane.
Going forward, one of the performances has to do with, like you were alluding to, maximum load capability, which has to be reduced out of necessity. Industry articles I've read believe that prices will have to go up commensurately.
It would, just to offset that lost revenue. The operating cost of the aircraft doesn't change, even though it would operate potentially at a lighter weight. There's just not the economics in there to take that many revenue paying mm-hmm. seats offline and make it work.
So bottom line, going forward in our lives, our world, be prepared for higher cost of travel, air travel.
In the near term, I think that's certainly one of the rebound effects we may mm-hmm. see, but it really comes back to the demand picture. If the public becomes comfortable with flying and we return to a pre-COVID level of activity in the near future, and that the vulnerabilities of this crisis are either removed or managed in ways that we see that activity return, you know, the cost of flying may not be dramatically affected, but mm-hmm. in my opinion, it's probably too soon to tell.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Correspondent Tom Wilmer speaks with Kevin Booman of the San Luis Obispo County Regional Airport.
Let's reel back to the here and now where
sure.
we are at San Luis Obispo County Airport. And you all have come up with a protocol that you pushed out to the media just in the last week.
Yeah.
Talk to us about that and what it's about.
So we launched our nonstop service campaign, which really highlights all the things we're doing here at our facility to ensure that the highest standards of sanitation and cleanliness are met with additional custodial work above and beyond what we typically do, and that is a continuous process. We've got signage added into the airport for social distancing, reminders on precaution, we've got messaging in place, and really trying to emphasize that we are going that extra distance and providing the levels of service that people would expect. Airports across the country are doing this. Certainly the measures reflect whatever local requirements may be in place, and also the scale of their traffic. We're a very small airport, and we have found kind of the right application of these procedures and processes right now. As our traffic continues to grow, we'll be continuing to amplify those with the volume. But we're very proud of the standards we're able to maintain at this point, and we hope the public finds that to be above and beyond their expectations.
Right over your shoulder is the TSA line. Is there any protocol for the passenger on social distance spacing, and how do you ensure that they keep 6 feet away in the TSA line, for example?
So like many of the places we go today, the grocery store and others, mm-hmm. we have asked for the 6 foot spacing, social distancing spacing.
Is that signage over there too?
Yeah, we have signage at the queue areas for both ticketing and check-in. We have it at the checkpoint, and then we also have it at the gates. People may notice here, we don't have anything on the floor.
Right, no X's on the floor.
And that's not because we didn't want to do it, but the type of floor finish we have here, people have commented over the years now about our beautiful concrete floors. One of the unfortunate things about this type of floor is you cannot put adhesive on it without mm-hmm. damaging the finish. It will peel up and cause problems. So we have not gone with a floor application.
Right. But yet the traveler knows to do their best to keep that distance.
We are reminding them in every way we can.
How about the process of wearing a mask as you transit through TSA and through the terminal
pre-boarding? Great question, yeah. The masks are required on the aircraft in accordance with the airline's requirements. There is no federal requirement for that, and in our county, there's no local requirement.
So can United strictly enforce that?
The airlines are enforcing that on board the aircraft for boarding. They want people to have masks, and they will provide masks.
And what if somebody said, I don't want to wear a mask?
That's an interesting question, because we're seeing a much more rigorous approach to that now. It is no longer optional. Would they deny boarding? I'm not going to speak for the carriers, but it wouldn't surprise me if they did. The challenge we have in this industry right now is that there's no federal requirement within the regulations for masks. The state and local requirements vary throughout the country. And so as the airport here in San Luis Obispo, we're looking at across that spectrum from federal to local. There is no mask requirement. So we made the decision here that masks are welcome, but they are not required.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're seeing is a vast majority of people are wearing them. That's excellent. We're very happy about that. But as soon as you transition from you're welcome to wear it to you're required to wear mm-hmm. it becomes a much different interface that you're creating with the customer. For example, when someone's not wearing it. And we have taken the guidance from our local health officer, Dr. Bornstein, and we are following that protocol within the county that it is not required in this county. And until it is, we don't intend to implement them, or until the federal government says within airports you must wear them. And I'm sure there would be a lot of debate around that. We've had a lot of internal debate. It's been honestly a really tough decision for us to make. We feel we have the right application at the right time, and if there's a need to change it in the future, we certainly will.
Kevin Boomen, your job, your world is travel. Is aviation. And your family, you're planning and hoping to go on a holiday pretty soon. What sort of protocol are you planning as a family in your travel? But as far as preparedness, wearing gloves.
Yeah. It involves, the masks, having them available and wearing them, when needed and where needed. Lots of hand sanitizer, the usual precautions. Haven't used gloves yet, but certainly they're one thing that is worth considering. And in a high-risk area if you're going to go there.
I've been working for two ICU nurses from French Hospital, mm-hmm. and we were talking yesterday about the use of gloves. And the one nurse said, well, if you wear a glove, that's just another layer of your hand. So you still have that same vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And they said more important is what you were alluding to is frequently refreshing of squirting your hands with alcohol or whatever.
Sanitization.
And just over and over again. I mean, they do it coming and going every single portal and gauntlet.
Absolutely. And that will be part of the new normal. We've added hand sanitizer stations
in
several locations around the airport. Mm-hmm. We have a supply now to keep those as continuously stocked as we can, but that is a really important part of this. I think, you know, if we imagine what do the next 6 months look like here, I think the two big variables I see out there, and there are many, but the two that pop up are what happens here if there's a second wave. And I think we see a decline in service beyond what we've already seen, meaning that we would probably see more destinations suspended and beyond that. The other thing that we're watching closely is the airlines received CARES Act grants similar to airports. And as part of that, they have requirements to maintain their network at a given level until September 30th, unless the DOT approves their withdrawal from a market. And we recently saw that with Delta withdrawing from Santa Barbara.
Oh, really?
They received early approval from DOT to remove from that market. That being said, if we continue to see our traffic improve like it is now, I'm not concerned about September 30th. But if we were to see things flatten or slow down for one of many reasons, do the airlines take a hard look at this market beyond September 30th? Absolutely. So it's really important for us over the next few months to be showing positive signs of growth. Now, you may wonder, well, where are we in that spectrum right now? When we hit the very bottom of this, we were seeing 50 to 75 departing passengers a day on a total of 5 to 6 flights a day.
Cumulatively. Wow.
So 5 to 10 people per flight at the worst. Mm-hmm. Now, today, we're seeing between 250 and 300 passengers departing per day.
So load per aircraft.
And we're
average.
Still on the same number of flights per day.
So how many people per aircraft?
Average roughly? Loads, I'd say we're probably in the 20 to 25 per aircraft. Mm-hmm. So depending on the airplane, you could be 50%.
So still a chance to get upgraded to first class then.
Hopefully. That depends on day of week and destination and whatnot. But we're seeing positive signs there. So when we've looked at our performance compared to peer airports around the country, we're consistently sitting within the top 10 of the non-hub airports in the United States for return of passenger service, which is encouraging because that shows the strength of our local market. It shows the demand that we're starting to see related to tourism. And, of course, the state of California is now on a county-by-county basis allowing non-essential travel to occur. And so we are seeing some activity there begin again. We've got a long way to go, but we're moving in the right direction.
Kevin, to learn more, if somebody was curious about aviation travel in and out of San Luis Obispo County, website?
SlowAirport.com. Lots of information about the airport and our current flight activity is there on the arrivals and departures page. There is information related to COVID and precautions. It does change frequently, and there are many sources out there. TSA has got some information up related to some additional ways that they're managing the check-in process through the checkpoint. So lots of information out there that folks can find what our flight schedules look like today, what sort of precautions they may need to take for health and safety. And we're updating that as things develop.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from the San Luis Obispo County Airport, where we've been visiting with Kevin Boomen, the airport director.
Wilmer and Boomen spoke last Thursday. Later that same day, Governor Newsom released new state guidelines requiring the use of masks in public places. Working Lunch is a weekly Facebook Live conversation between the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce and someone in the community doing interesting or innovative work. Today, we'll hear from Michelle Call of San Luis Obispo's Gay and Lesbian Alliance, or GALA. June is LGBTQ Pride Month to commemorate the Stonewall Riots, which occurred at the end of June 1969.
I'm Jim D'Antona, President and CEO of the SLO Chamber, and today You get a peek behind the curtain of the incredibly important work happening with Michelle Call, Executive Director of the Gala Pride and Diversity Center. While some may be most familiar with the annual Pride celebration, the center works year-round to create a safe place for everyone on the gender and sexuality spectrum. Committed to ensuring a healthy and vibrant network of social gatherings, support groups, events, educational services, and business resources for all individuals, the organization reflects the rich social life of the LGBTQ plus community and its allies in our county. After volunteering with the center for more than 10 years, Michelle became the organization's first executive director in 2018 and has been hard at work in what she calls her ultimate dream job ever since. I'm so looking forward to talking to Michelle about the recent Supreme Court decision, Pride Month in the time of COVID, and what's new at the organization. Thank you so much for being here, Michelle.
Thank you so much for having me, Jim. I'm delighted.
Well, before we dig into all the amazing things going on locally, obviously this week has been pretty surprising in a great way with the Supreme Court. And I want to take a moment to talk about the Supreme Court's landmark LGBTQ plus rights decision earlier this week. For those who may not be familiar with Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, can you share a quick overview of the impact of that ruling?
Absolutely. Thank you. So the Civil Rights Act was passed in 1968. And the part that we're talking about is Title IX. And that's the part that says that you can't discriminate against somebody when you're hiring or firing on the basis of sex and race and religion and all those things. And so there's been some question as to whether that applies to sexual orientation and gender identity.
And so now with that ruling, it seems that it would apply and they get all the same protections that others are entitled to, correct?
Yes, so it's definitely the beginning. There's still a lot to fight for, but conservative Justice Neil Gorsuch said in his decision that the limits of the drafter's imagination supply no reason to ignore the law's demands. And so what he was saying in that is just because we didn't have the awareness we have now doesn't mean that those protections shouldn't extend to people of all sexual orientations and gender identities.
Particularly when it comes to right health outcomes, equal access to health care. And you, earlier this week when we were doing a little conversation, you shared some alarming stats about health risks for LGBTQ plus people locally, both related to and existing before COVID.
Yes, I was talking about the HIV statistics in our county, which I got from Access Support Network. They do HIV, Hep C testing and support. And we talked about Slo County HIV rates. If you're a white man who has sex in men, your chance of catching HIV is 1 in 13. If you're a Latino man, it's 1 in 4. And if you're a black man, it's 1 in 2. All these underlying health conditions and intersectional identities just increase the risk of catching and having trouble from complications.
Certainly as a community, we're obviously aware of, but you don't hear it every day. And so when you hear shocking statistics at that level, it really brings it home. I think helps people understand why it's important that we are making sure to cover all of these pieces.
Right, right. Because when you add the extra piece on, when you're LGBTQ, you're already at risk. Then if additionally you're Black or additionally you have a disability, things like that, it just piles on. Actually, in his dissent, Judge Alito was concerned that this might be a slippery slope, that now gay and transgender people might also have access to health care and all these other things, kind of laying out the roadmap for us.
Well, obviously, June is Pride Month. And as it is, you know, coinciding with the groundswell of support for the Black Lives Matter movement, many people are becoming reacquainted with the origins of Pride at Stonewall. Can you share a little bit about the key role that trans women of color have played in gay rights and the overall kind of impact of Pride at Stonewall?
Actually, the Stonewall Inn was really supported by the Genovese crime family, and it was mob bosses that were keeping these places going by bribing the cops. There wasn't even a liquor license at the Stonewall Inn. So a lot of folks, and especially Black folks would congregate and to celebrate their gender identity, their sexual orientation, and to be free with each other. And several of these people, like Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera, were right there in the thick of it when whoever forgot to bribe the cop that night or chose not to, and then the place was raided, they weren't allowed to wear clothes of the opposite gender, and their genders were being checked by the police. And Marsha P. Johnson wasn't having any of that. She wasn't going to allow it. It kind of went from there, went five nights. We had a lot of things going on, and it was really the beginning of the modern struggle for gay rights. This isn't necessarily to do with Stonewall. We talked about the intersections before. Black transgender men and women are at the highest risks for violence. And actually, the United States has more murders of trans people than any other country apart from Brazil and Mexico. It's really an issue that we need to be dealing with, as I'm seeing a lot of that. I'm seeing a lot of all Black Lives Matter, talking about Black Trans Lives Matter, and bringing that to the forefront as well, so that we can seek justice for all people.
This year's Pride, obviously in the time of COVID, will take place mostly virtually. And people should probably take a look at your website for all the info, but I was hoping you could share a few highlights and elements that you're most excited for.
I would love to just share about three different things that we have going on. One isn't us, but is Santa Maria House of Pride and Equality, which is an LGBTQ organization in Santa Maria, is doing four or five evenings of Pride. It's going to be from the 22nd through the 26th, and they're doing all kinds of activities. You can find out what they're doing at santamariapride.com. It's all one word, santamariapride.com. They're going to have panels of people talking about things. They're going to have drag shows, all kinds of different community activities. Their website is fabulous, and I highly recommend that. And then the last thing I wanted to talk about briefly is on the 27th of June, there's going to be a 24-hour global Pride. And this is the big thing that's come together out of COVID, is almost all the Pride celebrations that are in person have been canceled. Even if we could get together, that many people to be exposed is not a good idea. So everywhere around the world is coordinating this Pride. And our art curator, Lynn Schmidt, who is also a photographer, has been very involved with that. So people should tune into that. And then they can also come by the center from 1 to 3 on a Saturday afternoon on the 27th. And we're going to have drag queens. They can pick up t-shirts that they've pre-ordered, or they can take a photo on our new rainbow steps, all those kinds of things. So all that information is also on our website.
Really, one of the things from the chamber side we've noticed is there has been some, even though we love being together in person and celebrating each other and connecting, we've actually found some upsides to having virtual events. Are you seeing some of that same from on the events that you're working on, especially like you just talked about, right? A worldwide kind of event that everybody can participate in.
Yes, we're definitely, so there are some struggles and there are some people who do much better meeting in person, but we're also finding our online groups are more accessible to a lot of people, and we may continue a hybrid afterwards, particularly the Gay Men's Book Club. They went virtual almost immediately, and they found that members who've long since moved away came back and are now participating in the group again, and they're having catch-ups, reunions, and they really love it.
Sometimes for people who just aren't as social, it's great to kind of be in a safe space that they're comfortable with and making those connections. But that sounds amazing too, that finding ways to bring back that connection.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. You're listening to a conversation between Gala's Michelle Call and the San Luis Obispo Chamber's Jim D'Antona.
And as part of it, you kind of mentioned in that poetry. And I often see poetry is an integral part of the Pride celebration. Why do you think there is such a natural pairing of the two?
I think that poetry and poetry to music, which is song, right, is a powerful method of expression. And I think that it just helps people to get their thoughts out, to share those kinds of things, and it helps us to hear it. When I hear a poem that really resonates with me, I love spoken word poetry. I love those poetry slams. It's a whole different way of communicating that really just gets to the heart of things.
Back before COVID-19, you were leading a number of substantial efforts for the organization, including a name change and new support groups. Tell me a little bit about those initiatives and where do they stand right now?
So I was hired, like you said, in 2018. And one of the things that the board said when they hired me is that they were planning to do this name change and a focus shift as well. So we were the Gay and Lesbian Alliance since 1997 when we were incorporated. And that was fine for the time, but we've come to understand that there are lots more letters in LGBTQ than just the gays and lesbians. Although, you know, we totally still appreciate and gays and lesbians are a huge part of our organization. But we wanted to figure out how to change our name and our attitude to be more inclusive. So we had a town hall meeting in July of 2018 where we answered questions from some members and things like that. And then we had a big vote just at the beginning of this year to amend our bylaws and institute our new name. And so that passed, and now we are in that process. We're about to get the letter back from the state. The state is a little bit behind at the moment due to COVID for doing the name change, but that will be our official piece. But we also have our new logo and all those things, and we will be revealing that on the 27th of June at our Pride celebration.
One of the things that we were kind of talking about, and I think it's one of the efforts, is people who are LGBTQ plus are particularly impacted by the chains brought on by COVID, as we were talking before on the susceptibility of health. It sounds like those support groups and summer camps that are coming together, that you're putting on some of those, are coming at an incredibly impactful time. Is that happening this summer?
Definitely. So we're actually in the first week of a summer camp. We have a wonderful youth summer camp director, Mia Rolfe, who's an intern, and they are doing an amazing job. We're finding that a lot of our youth were thirsty for something. I think they've been at home. There's been no school. There's been no contact. So they're doing part of it online and then part in person with masks and socially distanced. And I think it's really making a positive mental health impact. Being apart, being isolated is hard.
Yeah, it's very difficult for all of us. And even more so when you, again, as you said, the intersectional challenges that happen on a lot of these pieces. It just layers on, correct?
Correct. And actually, you know, it's interesting because we're talking about all this name change, this new focus and all of that. And I firmly believe that in order for us to be a Pride and Diversity Center, we really have to be able to speak to the communities that we want to serve. So that's one of the things that I'm doing this year is I'm taking intensive Spanish classes. I believe it's really important for me to be bilingual as the director of the organization. I expect in the next 6 months, I will be fully bilingual. I'm putting a lot into it. And that's really exciting to me because I feel like as we move forward into the community, we're going to be able to be even more effective.
How have you found it to be? Have you gotten pretty good?
I love it. In fact, I'm working with live tutors in various countries through a website called Baselang. And yesterday I was working with Cesar to translate the presentation I have about the Gala Center into Spanish. And we were translating the new mission statement and stuff like that. And it's just really, it's really fulfilling and exciting. And I think I maybe had even forgotten a bit how fulfilling it is to learn something new that's a real challenge. And to go into something like this, and it's making me feel good in all the other areas as well. So yeah, I highly recommend doing something new.
So much of your work focuses on the importance of safe spaces, even how you're improving your own personal abilities. Despite a decently large LGBTQ plus population, why do you think we've been unable to sustain maybe a queer bar, lounge, coffee shop in SLO since Breezes closed in the 90s?
That's a great question. So Breezes was fabulous. We love Lisa Dean, and the Central Coast Queer Archive Project is currently putting together all those memories, which is really fantastic. And since Breezes closed, we've had all kinds of one-off functions. There were queer nights out for several years. Allies like Slow Provisions and Novo have held events, but we really haven't had a gathering space other than the Gala Center, and we're not set up for just, you know, casual drop-in visiting. I don't know why, but I would love to see a coffee shop. I don't particularly want a bar because, although it could serve alcohol, right? But I want something that's for the whole family. And so I would be really happy to see some coffee shop that was LGBTQ plus focused. And I would go there a lot.
Certainly the idea of family-friendly Pride events, is that the Gala's focusing on too? Are there options for that?
Yes. So um, we we were doing several in-person events when we could do that. We usually have an annual family picnic in the summer. We've done drag queen story hour. Wonderful local drag queen Juicy came and did story hour for us. That was amazing. And we have open houses where you can meet the board, and we do open mic. There's lots of family. And of course, the summer camp is 6 weeks of only family stuff. So yes, we do events that are for adults only as well, of course, like our wonderful drag shows. But it's really important that we do that, the whole family focus. And so yes, we are definitely do that.
And really proud of our community, as we're doing banners around the community, talking about our community, what we stand for. And I believe Juicy is one of the banners highlighting Pride, right?
You know, I think I want to say that's Rosé All Day.
Oh, okay.
Rosé All Day is another one of our fabulous local drag queens. Yes. And I think that one's near the train station.
Correct. You know, yeah. And I love that the city was invested in highlighting that, and the community got around it again to make sure that we have a safe space in our community for everyone. I know there have been a lot of changes in all of our lives and organizations because of COVID. Are there any changes personally or professionally that you think or hope will be permanent as part of this?
Well, one of the things that I don't think I'm ever going to do again is shake hands with someone. And I thought about times in the past when I've shaken hands with someone and I knew they had a cold or something, but I'm British and I felt like my politeness was more important than my health. No, that's not the case. So I don't think I'll be shaking hands again. I will be finding other ways to greet people and that kind of thing. And I think the other thing that I've really embraced during this time is more intentional meetings with people and not just bumping into them. So I was very much relying on going to a group event or a chamber event or something like that. And I would bump into people there and I would talk to them about this or the other thing. Now I've been doing a lot of setting half hour Zoom chats to catch up with people and having an intentional half hour conversation, and it's made a huge difference.
Do you think popular culture intersects with change making efforts like the more direct education and advocacy work that Gala leads?
Yes, absolutely. I think that we're seeing a great deal more LGBTQ+ exposure in media, in television shows, in all that kind of thing. I'm seeing same-sex relationships. I'm seeing non-binary characters. I'm seeing all that kind of thing just being presented as a normal part of the show, whereas 10 or 20 years ago, that was definitely not the case. So I just think that the normalization is super helpful for everyone.
So with all that's going on right now, is there someone you are especially grateful for, someone who's really shown up and made a difference for you?
Yes, I am especially grateful for my friend and mentor, Dr. Leola Dublin McMillan. I feel like she has been showing up for our town, for our county, for our state, and for me. And as we work through these things, and as the Gala Board and the Trans Central Coast Steering Committee try to become more diverse and inclusive, Leola is leading that for us. She's helping us to figure all those things out, and she has absolutely been a rock. And I'm so grateful for her presence in my life.
Thanks again, Michelle.
Well, thank you for having me.
That was Michelle Call of Gala, speaking with Jim D'Antona on the latest edition of the San Luis Obispo Chamber's Working Lunch. And finally, an estuary is any body of water where freshwater streams and rivers meet ocean salt water. Together, the estuary's calm waters and abundant vegetation make the perfect haven for thousands of species, including the endangered southern sea otter. And while estuarian waters in Morro Bay and Elkhorn Slough help endangered species recover, estuaries themselves are in jeopardy due to a rapid decline of eelgrass beds, underwater plants vital to healthy waterways. As Sukmani Brower reports, new research suggests sea otters are actively aiding in eelgrass recovery.
The health of estuaries along the central coast depends heavily on the presence of eelgrass. Eelgrass beds consist of long, slender blades of green grass that wave to and fro with the tide.
The analogy that I like to sort of give for many coastal estuarine environments is the trees are to the Amazon rainforest as the seagrass or the eelgrass is to an estuarine environment.
Ryan Walter is a physicist at San Luis Obispo's Cal Poly University. as part of a grant funded by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. He's researching how the physics of estuary waters affects eelgrass growth.
They're so critical. It's not just a blade of eelgrass or a meadow of eelgrass. It has so many different ecosystem services. They call them these ecosystem engineers because they really structure the entire ecosystem.
Some of these functions include providing a refuge for fish, supplying food for migratory birds, and preventing erosion. Eelgrass also filters nutrients from the water column. But according to observational data collected by the Morro Bay National Estuary Program, there has been a 90% decline in eelgrass acreage in the Morro Bay estuary over the last decade. Why that is? It's a mystery and an active area of research. Research has shown stronger water currents may affect eelgrass growth. Stronger currents kick up more sediment, increasing the cloudiness of the water, which might hinder eelgrass growth because the cloudier the water, the less light rays can reach the eelgrass beds for photosynthesis. And the decline in eelgrass is associated with erosion.
Historically, Morro Bay has been accreting sediment over the last century, but we found over the last decade that Morro Bay has actually been eroding in places that previously held eelgrass. We're talking about half a meter of erosion in some places.
This fast-paced erosion is already changing the sediment structure of the bay and will likely have cascading ecological effects. Estuaries also increasingly serve as safe harbors for sea otters, away from the dangers of the open ocean.
What we've really been seeing for about the last 20 years is an increasing level of shark bite mortality. And what that's doing is limiting the ability of the southern sea otter to expand into new areas.
But, says Lillian Carswell with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service,
one thing we've seen is how well they thrive in estuaries, and that's something we hadn't fully recognized in the past.
So how do increased numbers of sea otters contribute to increased levels of eelgrass? Cal Poly biologist Lisa Needles says the resurgence in eelgrass in areas with sea otters has to do with their feeding habits.
One of the cool things that we've been finding is the importance of these top predators on restoring degraded ecosystems and on providing resilience to these ecosystems from other threats.
This happens through what's called a trophic cascade, basically how the food chain works in life's connected web. Since sea otters eat crabs,
when otters are in the system, crabs go down, these mesograzers go up. That decreases the algal growth on the eelgrass, so the eelgrass can photosynthesize better.
While the presence of sea otters has been critical to the revival of eelgrass in Elkhorn Slough Estuary, it is still scarce in Morro Bay, especially in the back portions of the bay, where there are few to no sea otters. If trends follow the data in Elkhorn Slough and sea otters move into the back portion of the Morro Bay Estuary, it may trigger a significant revival in eelgrass throughout. Reporting for KCBX News, I'm Sukhmani Brar.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments. It's at kcbx.org.